Hello? Hello? Is there anyone out there? Welcome back to this season two of Storytelling for Social Impact podcast. I'm really delighted you're joining me again on these monthly episodes where we unpack how to tell better stories to make a positive difference in the world. We share examples of great campaigns and stories and why they worked so well. And other examples that really didn't work well and why that was as well. Each guest, I ask them to share a sustainable development goal that means something to them and why, which gives us a sense of what really makes them tick and what their purpose is aligned to. So this season, I have a whole range of incredible guests, ranging from impact investment fund managers and directors to directors of fundraising who've been fundraising for over 40 years to strategy consultants and ideas people who are guiding and mentoring some of the biggest leaders in the social impact space. A huge range of different types of people, all unified by one thing though, that their lives in many ways have been committed to wanting to make a positive impact on the world, and how stories can help us all do that better. Today, I had an incredible guest, Howard Lake. I met him in the late 2000s. He was, by that stage, already 20 years into an incredible fundraising career. He'd worked in the 80s with big charities like Oxfam, Amnesty, Afghan Aid. So he'd really learned the industry from the inside out. And then he went out and became an entrepreneur, if you like, and started the first fundraising website and community in 1994, wrote the first book on digital fundraising in 1996, and has been a real pioneer in the whole fundraising space. He sold his company UK Fundraising in 2022 and has stayed on as a consultant and is doing amazing work still around the world, running workshops with fundraising leaders. And he's also got a company called GivingX, where he's exploring how fundraising can be supported at scale and also using AI. So he's always been a curious, innovative guy at the cutting edge of fundraising. We had a great conversation all about AI, the opportunities, the dangers, also the tensions in organizations, fundraising organizations, between often the board level, which is there to make sure the organizations stay on a steady keel, and the fundraisers who are maybe looking to use emotion and storytelling more, and how that tension in the organizations often differentiates the organizations that stay carrying on where they're at or the ones that can really grow and get closer to their mission of solving whatever big problem it is they're trying to solve. The examples he gave were brilliant. They really showed how getting to the heart of a story and finding those stories that are not necessarily where you expect them to come from is the skill of a great storytelling organization. So thank you for joining me again. Please make sure to subscribe because we have a lot of great guests coming up. And if you'd leave us a review and let some friends know about it who might also learn something from these podcasts, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much. Let's dive in. Howard, after quite a while, lovely to see you.
I do. Lovely to see you, Ravi. Thank you.
So I met you, didn't I? Probably in, let me think, the late 2000s. But you, by that stage, had already been probably 20 years into fundraising. As far as I understand, you started your career in the late 80s. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. I was a student fundraiser where I suddenly found out I could fundraise in the mid 80s and then just turned that into a career, which was very enjoyable.
Amazing.
And surprising.
And you've been innovative. You know, in the 90s, you started the first website and community online for fundraisers. You wrote a book about digital fundraising. Now, the internet was in its early years, if let's say. So that was quite a step forward. And obviously now you're working on some AI stuff, we'll come to that in some depth. But what would you say was the key thing that kind of attracted you or drew you to some of the more cutting edge things that were untried and untested at that time?
I think because in my view, it wasn't untried and untested, even at that point. That's true of the charity sector. But I was reading about digital, although we called it the World Wide Web in capitals at that point. And online, sometimes with a hyphen in between on and line. Mm. It was in every Sunday paper. There were supplements. This was sort of 93, 94. So it wasn't unusual. And we'd already got dial-up for common humans like me from home. That was 1992 for, what was it, a tenner a month?
Yeah.
So this stuff was not new. But I knew from my experience in the charity sector that it was never going to be at the cutting edge.
Yeah.
Not that it should be. That's not its job. Its job is to do its work.
Yeah.
But I knew they would need some help. So that's kind of what convinced me that I needed to look into it, build something to share and help bring the sector forward.
And I guess that's the thing, isn't it? It's like you say, it was established, but it wasn't necessarily established in every sphere or sector. And there are certain sectors that tend to be more innovative and risk-taking and all of that, and others that may be a bit more conservative and traditional and slower to take action. So I think that's why it was such a kind of transformational thing when you did do it. When you did do it in the beginning, were charities quite quick to take you up on it, or was it a more of a slow burn?
It was a slow burn. There was not a lot of interest. And that's fine. I didn't really expect that. There was more interest in the US, not surprisingly, where a lot of the technology was booming faster.
Mm.
So this was sort of 1993, 94, 95. So I was working as a fundraiser then at Amnesty International UK.
Mm.
My colleagues absolutely admitted they didn't quite get what I was doing, but they knew it was really important and wished me on. So I kind of took heart that there were some early adopters who were willing to support. And also there were other people looking at this kind of stuff from different angles within the charity sector. So we found our tribe and had lovely events like tweet-ups for those that had discovered Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever, 2008, 2009. Mm. So we got together in person to sort of thrash out how could we use this for social good.
And later you did fundraising camp as well, which I know we filmed some stuff for you.
You did. Thank you so much. I still share that from time to time.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that all these years on.
That
was really good.
But you'd established your career with the big charities. So you knew the charity sector well. You were with Oxfam, you were with Amnesty, Afghan Aid. And then when you started Fundraising UK, did you venture out on your own? Did you become an entrepreneur, if you like, at that point?
I did. Now I describe that's what I did at the time. It was just one very big, scary jump.
Yes.
So I left Amnesty. So Amnesty was the third charity that I fundraised for to run UK fundraising. So it was a site that I always planned to give the information away for free, to publish for free. Not that paywalls existed at that point, but I had to make money from it. So it was kind of learning as I went every day, trying to work out how do you generate income?
How did you make the money from that?
It's all advertising based.
Okay.
So charities never have to pay to access it, but all the fundraising agencies, companies, advisors that wanted to reach our audience, as long as I could evidence I was reaching the right kind of people in sufficient numbers, they were prepared to pay. So that's been lovely. So thank you to all the advertisers over the years who made it possible.
Well,
do it that way. But
you wouldn't do it that way again, or?
No, I think that's quite a hard push. I would probably do some kind of subscription based. I mean, a bit like Substack or something.
But I think that's probably, I can understand why you'd say that, but I think that was kind of unheard of then. It's more common now to pay, even for things like newspapers online. I think that's been a painful shift for them too, for people to pay for stuff that they used to get for free.
Yes, absolutely. That's true. And I can also admit that maybe I was wrong to give it away for free, because that kind of encourages certainly my audience of charities to think that everything should be free or
that's an
reduced.
Interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's a point that it sounds like you were hinting at it there. It can be a frustrating component of the charity sector. It can sometimes be stuck in a poverty mindset a little bit, I think. You know?
Yeah.
It's a shift to look towards a more sort of market-based, I guess, mindset.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
I always ask each guest, is there an SDG that is close to their heart, whether it's professionally or just personally, and what it might be and why? So what's yours?
I think this is professional and personal. It's goal number 5, gender equality. Achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls. I know every single goal matters, but I think unless you crack this one and achieve it, none of the others are ever going to happen, or they're going to happen at such a slow speed. If you're holding back one half of the human population, then where do we go? I mean, to me, it's if you had to choose one, that would be the one I chose.
Wow, that's a really good point, because I've never heard it exactly positioned like that before. Half the potential is missed out on, if you like. Yeah. And have you got a daughter or kids or nieces?
I have a daughter. Yeah. I have one son and one daughter. So yes, there is a personal element seeing how she can get on in the world and the barriers she faces that I didn't as a male. So yes.
So in terms of storytelling, you've had many, I suppose I'm going to say many decades, probably, what are we looking at now?
True.
quite a few, maybe 40 years almost.
Heading towards 40, yes.
So keen to hear what we can learn from you. So in terms of storytelling across fundraising, which obviously has been your world, what are some of the key ingredients, if you like, that you've seen that help or hinder? Give us some insights, yes, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. I would say, and yes, this is, let's say I'm in the second half of my career. I think the key thing which I've learned, and again, more towards the end of my career than the beginning, is the importance of emotion. Storytelling is everything in fundraising. If you doubt that, then just think of some of the arguments you've been involved with over which text, which image gets used, and even which case study. It's so riven with debate and dispute because it matters. And at the heart of this storytelling is emotions. So fundraising is absolutely an emotional business. And it's only when you realize that you actually can unlock some of the power within the organization and certainly the ability to fundraise at scale. There's a great quote from Alan Clayton, who I work with quite a lot. And he said, emotions are why we do things. Logic is why we don't.
Interesting.
And so many of us, including me as a young fundraiser, I really focused on the logic. The logic was, here's an injustice. We can fix it. It'll take money and skill. Let's do it.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not the case. You have to tell a good story.
Yeah. And how do you strike the balance between, because I think you can get emotion fatigue as well. You know, sometimes it can go into hyper mode where people feel they're manipulated, if you like. It's a delicate balance, isn't it?
If you're manipulating someone, you're not doing good fundraising. Yeah, it can happen. We can also feel, desperate. These are really hard times for many fundraisers and charity leaders, just endlessly hard times. Mm. If it doesn't feel right, then it's not right. The primacy of the donor or the donors truly matter. I mean, it's kind of an obvious statement. Mm. If we don't take care of them and meet their needs, then it's not going to work. A, you will annoy, upset, and lose donors. And B, you won't achieve your charity's purpose. Mm. So it all comes down to with the right emotion and speaking emotionally, which puts you on the same level as donors. Mm. It means you're not talking down to them. We, the great charity, are doing this. Please help. It's, what do you need? What can we provide to you? So it's finding the right people. So you mentioned emotion fatigue. Yeah, but that's probably a sign that the wrong people are being communicated with. Mm-hmm. If you have a conversation with someone and you feel the emotion, empathy with that cause, then that's probably the right direction. Something is working there. There's the overlap of your purpose, your personal purpose in life, what you want to see the difference in the world you want to make, and the purpose of the charity. There are 180,000 charities in England and Wales. No one supports all of them. No one is interested in all of their causes. It's the few causes that you think about that matter to you in your life and your family and day-to-day life. So yes, so it shouldn't happen.
It's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I was thinking in terms of, say, like Comic Relief. Over the years, they've changed their approach a little bit, because I think there was a point where, understandably, sometimes charities may continue with a certain formula because it appears to work. Like, in other words, people do give, but they might be giving out of guilt or, whatever it is. So I think they used to really turn up the tearjerker stuff, and it does work. But I suppose that's the difference between maybe what works in the short term. Like in the commercial sector, we see it in the push for short-term profits, quarterly returns, et cetera, rather than a longer-term vision. Being inside charities and so on, have you ever come across things like that where charities, something's worked for them for a long time and then they've realized that they have to change tact, if you like?
Definitely, all the time. People change. Reasons to give don't. Mm. And that's true around the world. I've worked with charities in various places through Alan Clayton's company. So the reasons to give don't change. They don't change at all. But people's awareness of charity, of needs, understanding of charities, they do change. So talking about being emotional and telling stories, the same story will resonate very differently to my daughter comparing to my parents. People are different. The world has moved on, just the way they consume information, the culture wars as well at the moment. So yeah, sometimes you find your fundraising method has to change and move with the times. That's true of commercial businesses as well.
Absolutely. So I guess we're saying that the form needs to change and adapt, but the essence is pretty much still is the same.
Yeah, the essence is the same. So it's really how do you present that? It's the purpose. It's the why of the charity. That doesn't change. The charity was founded to make a difference. A small group of people got together over a kitchen table or in a pub quite often, or in a bar, which is where plenty of charities were founded in the 20th century. And they want to make a difference. And that's the purpose that charities sustain for decades, or even in some cases like the RNLI, over 200 years. And they couldn't survive, and they couldn't carry on doing their work if they weren't staying true to that purpose, and if that purpose didn't resonate with lots of individuals.
Yeah.
How you present it over time is the real skill of fundraising.
Yes. And have you seen a need for charities to adapt, or it becoming more difficult to fundraise, as, let's say, civic society and religious institutions, which would have been the bedrock of moral society at one point, are changing as well in terms of the donor base or the donor sentiment, if you like?
Yes, some things don't change. Young people don't give in substantial volume to help charities. So I think that's worth noting. But they will. They'll give when they're older and when they're more able to. Numbers are changing in terms of the number of people that give to charity. And this has been noted for a good few decades. The number of people in the UK who give to charity is declining.
Mm.
And that's true in the US as well. Mm. Yet income is going up for many charities, not all by any means. You still get good years of the amount given to charity, which means charities are relying on fewer people, which for civic society and the future of charities is not a good position to be in. So there's plenty of research on that.
Mm.
That's not a jibe at fundraisers or charities. They're working as hard as they can and as effectively as they can.
Mm.
But that is a social decline of the number of people willing to give money. And volunteering as well is down. It was down again last year. They measure it by the number of people who volunteer at least once a month during a year. And it's down to 1 in 10 of adults or something, which is low for this country.
Do you think I'm correct in thinking to some extent it's to do with a change in the way that things like religion would have at one time been, you know, those kind of morals of help your neighbor, mm-hmm. all of that kind of stuff would have been more prominent. I guess a lot of those charities were probably founded off the back of a lot of that thinking.
Yeah.
What's some of the discussion amongst charities about how to weather this storm or adapt? Are they focusing on new segments? Are they working more on high net worth? Like, how is the amount going up if the overall number is going down?
It's because fewer number of donors are tending to give more, which is fantastic. Mm. It's generous, but it's not necessarily a long-term approach. It's what you know about your existing donors is really the key to most successful fundraising, certainly sustainable fundraising.
Mm.
So yes, we do need to look around the corner for what's coming next, but that most charities recognize they need to understand their existing donors and ensure that they're meeting their donors' needs and finding other similar donors. And that's hard.
Mm.
Where's the focus now? Absolutely high net worth individuals, or just people who are in a wealthier position than either they might think so or you or I might think so.
Mm.
It's a complicated business, but there are some really sharp fundraisers doing the research to find out how many people do have liquid assets, whereas most people who have wealth in this country, it tends to be tied up
in their house.
So it's not something. Yes. But then that opens up the opportunity for legacy fundraising, enabling people to pledge to give some of the value of their estate when they die.
Yeah.
And we're in that transition, talking about a change earlier, the big change of boomers who own property, unlike many of their children.
It's a big wealth transfer.
And there's a big trickle down.
It is. And I guess you start to think about like the tax implications and so on. So it can be beneficial to give a portion to charity, isn't it, for that reason?
It is. I mean, one way of framing it is that that's usually the biggest gift you're ever able to give. You may want to support a charity, maybe one that you've got a particular family connection with, you know, a medical cause or something, or in memory of someone. And you're never able to give more than a bit during your lifetime. But you know, once you've provided for your family and others, that yes, the percentage, it would be quite an amazing way of ensuring your values live on.
Yeah, and it's a nice way to leave something behind of significance, yeah. What are some of the debates that you've heard in boardrooms or in senior charity conversations over the years about emotion, storytelling, and then maybe just the numbers and the sort of factual, more logical approach? Because you know, there's obviously is a tension, but how does that play out? Like, what are some of the phrases that get thrown around or the arguments for either side, if you like?
Yes, I've encountered resistance to storytelling and particularly emotion. The idea of emotion in any kind of business, whether for-profit or not-for-profit, is a really tricky area. Even though we know we've got the academic research by various academics in the philanthropy sector, that emotion is what matters. And we can evidence that. That's the great thing. You often find that it tends to only get to a certain level. Maybe a senior fundraiser gets it. Or if you're the sole fundraiser in a charity, you get it. You've read the books, you've been on the courses, all that kind of thing. But it stops at the board. And that's really quite understandable because there's a kind of built-in conservatism with a small c in UK charities. Because all that trustees have to do in terms of their legal requirement is to maintain a steady ship, to make sure that the organisation, you know, meets its budget, generates enough income to keep going. There is absolutely no legal requirement for a trustee, a board member, to get the charity closer to its purpose.
Wow, which is interesting, isn't it? Because the charity is being set up to fulfill its purpose. Like, that's its primary.
Yeah.
But I suppose each person in the team has a different role to play. Can you see benefit in that check and balance that the board might bring?
Oh, very much. I mean, without a healthy, well-managed finance operation, the charity falls over tomorrow. Absolutely. Yes. So there is that need.
Yes.
But, under that approach, there are charities that still manage to grow, sometimes a small amount, sometimes quite well. But it's not the attitude that will get a charity closer, faster to the reason it was set up.
So what would be the concern, let's say, from the board about wanting to use more storytelling, more emotion in the communications? What are they worried about?
They're worried that emotion means unprofessional. Uh-huh. And the reputation of a charity absolutely is everything. So if we go around telling fabulous emotional stories that work as fundraising, there's the risk that the public won't trust you. They'll think you're just do-gooders without any professional skills or anything. Why should I donate to them? There's that fear. It goes back to sort of Victorian values and so on of, you know, sackcloth and ashes and do-gooding is everything as a volunteer. The idea of professional charities still irks quite a chunk of the population. So board members and chief execs recognise that. Enough of them get beyond that quite appropriately. But yes, that's why emotion is a challenging thing to bring into a charity, because it makes people think, and it makes people think about some of the things that really matter to them and concern them. And if you want, you can even sort of boil storytelling down to the issue of addressing death and loneliness. Again, that's one Alan Clayton and his revolutionized team talk about. You're actually making people confront some really powerful feeling, which is why they give to charity, because they want to address them. They want to stop that happening to someone else.
Yeah, so I get you. It's like it's almost an existential fear that everyone has. I suppose perhaps the board are worried because those feelings are very powerful, but they're also, for some people, very uncomfortable and confronting, right?
Yeah, they are. And it's a worry about money as well. So the real skill of charities that wish to grow, to get closer to achieving their aim, is they need to recognize that fundraising is an investment business. You need to invest to grow. And that's terrifying for many organizations. That means less money initially, unless they have a pot somewhere, which is very unusual.
That's fascinating. We touched on it earlier. What is it that gets some charities beyond that? Because as you say, there can be my experience of charities can be, well, it's other people's job to give us money. And yes. we just kind of sort of are here to collect it all up and then spend it on the good stuff. So the idea yeah. of in any way reducing that number in the bank account, albeit for, you know, communications or fundraising or whatever it is a little bit terrifying, isn't it? So what's the difference between those who do, you know, sort of spend and invest and those who don't?
It is a recognition of some of these inherent clashes. And all this comes from the Revolutionized book, and it's based on academic research.
Put a link to it afterwards.
It's, yeah. Yeah.
What is it called?
Yeah. It's Great Fundraising Organizations is the book. And that gives examples from around the world of charities that have done it. They've effectively, the board has actually recognized that they need to invest. And again, that means usually having someone with experience with investment on the board. Mostly they have people who are sort of maintaining a charity's finances
yes.
safely. They don't have someone with experience of investing to grow.
Okay.
And that's one of the key things. There are other elements as well. That's one of the big leaps they need to make to enable them to grow.
So that the person who understands that process is one of them rather than someone below them. That person's on the yeah. same level on the board.
Yes. You need board buy-in. Otherwise, this doesn't happen. It doesn't come from below. It starts from below. Mm. But unless the board is convinced and is prepared to take the risk and the opportunity to invest, then fundraising won't grow.
Mm. And what would you, over your many years, think of as a great campaign or something that you loved or you thought was amazing or worked really well? Is there anything that comes to mind?
There are lots. I'm very lucky to have seen, either worked on quite a few campaigns, but also been on the receiving end of lots. Yeah. In publishing UK fundraising, I get stories every day yes. as press releases and so on. Mm. So there's a lot to choose from. I think probably one that's a more recent one is RNLI, Royal National Lifeboat Institute, so the lifeboats charity. Mm. And it's their approach to stories from some of their volunteer crew who get held up as heroes, because essentially they are. They save lives every day of the year, risking their own life. But they don't see themselves as heroes. And this only came out with conversations with them. So again, part of storytelling is listen to people and let them tell you the stories that they want to. And almost every single one of them had a story of the one they couldn't save.
Oh, yeah.
And when you hear those stories, you just think, oh, my God, you have saved tens of lives during your career. But the one thing that still upsets you is the one person they couldn't reach.
Yeah.
And that underpins so much of RNLI and its very clear focus on their continued need to grow. If one person drowns off the shores or in some of the inland areas of the UK, then there's a need for the RNLI.
Absolutely.
It's one life. And that's why, so that out of that came this very powerful message of save everyone.
Yeah, that's very powerful.
I can tell you it's even more powerful when you're in a room with this really big, burly, usually bearded, yeah. Strong guy in his RNLI safety gear. Mm. And you see them talk and it's not long before tears come.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing experience.
Yeah.
It just makes you want to give. They don't even have to ask. You want to give when you've heard those stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because I think for multiple reasons, just to try and analyze it a little bit, it shows the human cost, but not the human cost that you expected. It's slightly yeah. unexpected. You're thinking they're going to talk about the people who drowned, which they are in a way, but they're actually showing you the human cost on that individual in front of you because they chose to take on this thankless task, if you like. And it means that everyone they saved is all the more valuable or cherished, if you like, by thinking of the one that they weren't able to. It's very, very powerful. It's something that I've been talking about for quite a long time to organizations, which is don't make your organization the hero of the story. No matter how much you say this to an organization and how much they kind of get on board with the idea, as the project progresses, they will start to try and slip in, no, but it has to be all about us. And so my kind of point on this is that if you present, whether it's your volunteers, your team, your beneficiaries, your partners, as the heroes in the story, you always become the ultimate hero because you're the one bringing the story, facilitating the story, making the story possible. So I like to say it's almost like you're the postman or postwoman. You know, you've brought this letter, which you're giving them when they open it, you're giving them some magic or something wonderful. So they will look up at you and they will smile at you and all the goodwill will get transferred to you. So it's kind of counterintuitive. It still works for the organization, but the other way where it's just, we do this, we do that, you know, people just switch off. They don't want to hear about you telling us how great you are.
No, exactly. And that comes out in so many different ways. One, I remember learning quite early that people who give legacies, gifts in their wills to charities, so they have to write down the name of the charity in their will. And unless the solicitor has been particularly judicious and double-checked everything, they write the wrong name of charities. So if you needed any more evidence, they really don't, are not too bothered about exactly what you do and how. It's the cause. It's the cause they want. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's getting people to tell stories and everyone to tell a story within an organization, to have the confidence to be able to tell a story wherever they are, in a list, at a public meeting, or talking to someone in the queue at the supermarket. And that's different. Not many charities can do that.
Yes.
But it's a good sign when one can.
Yes. And do you think that, let's say, you may know in that instance how one comes to landing on a campaign like that? Obviously, you mentioned listening, looking for the patterns, hearing that, you know, so many of the volunteers would maybe say the same thing and seeing, oh, there's something in that. That's obviously one way. Do you think that there's value in organizations bringing in outside support as well? Because they can see sometimes things that they don't see internally. What's your experience with that, coming to really good messaging? Obviously, it can sometimes come internally, I'm sure, but also externally as well.
I think that can help. Definitely. It's part of it. Sometimes the pressure of working within a charity is so intense, there is very little time to sit back and think and refresh and review what you do and how. So yes, I think anyone that can tell stories and explain how they work and just give them the confidence to get individuals speaking, sometimes for the first time. And that's what is really eye-opening. Everyone at a charity, whether you're a staff member, CEO, beneficiary, service user, everyone has a story.
Yeah.
Not everyone can tell it compellingly straight off. So there's need for help and just practicing.
Yeah. I've heard it described as almost creating like a storytelling vault or going storytelling picking almost.
Yeah.
Like strawberry picking. That, you know, you don't know until you get curious with the different people who are involved and ask them their story, what might come out, right? What gold might be there?
Exactly that. You've hit on the word. It's curiosity. There's quite a few conversations I've had with fundraisers, and we've worked out some of the differences between fundraisers and other charity staff. It is curiosity. It's curiosity in individuals kind of wishing to find out more seems to be quite a common element. So therefore, yes, that's where you get the greatest stories, listening to people. I remember one thing at Amnesty. I used to sit around the corner from the receptionist, and they took all kinds of inquiries and complaints, questions, whatever. And I just realized they were listening to so many fabulous conversations and learning. So they were probably one of the most informed people at Amnesty UK, just because they were open to the public every day, every hour. So yes, be curious.
What's interesting there, isn't it, is perhaps that receptionist, maybe their job was just seen as just answer the phone, whatever. So it's kind of like figuring out where those stories might be hanging out and encouraging those people to pass them on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And I think part of becoming a much better fundraising organization is that you encourage people to do that, to share stories. You invite external speakers in, people who are good at it or people who work in the same area. And you invite people amongst your colleagues to do it, maybe in a Friday lunchtime session. Just get people practicing their stories and you end up with just the most astonishing stories of what motivates people to be there.
Yeah.
We know it's not just a job. You get some astonishing personal stories, sometimes told for the very first time because no one's ever asked them to.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you just realize the power of the whole organization And if it's pointing in the right way towards the same purpose, then yeah. those stories are part of the power that convey the need.
And the bigger story too. It starts to all feed into the collective story too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think what's interesting there is like you say, a lot of people won't ever step forward and tell their story if they're not asked.
Yes. Yeah, exactly that.
And I can just imagine, funny you mentioned about the receptionist. I wonder if it would be an interesting experiment. Imagine if once a month it was like, whether it was a little blog or whether it was standing up in front of everybody, but like, what's the best story or the best thing that's come across the receptionist's desk?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
I can't imagine that it's ever been done. I don't know, but it sounds like it could unlock some gold.
Yeah, there is gold in so many elements of everyday work in charity. And most of the time, we never have the time or inclination to do that. I'm going to go back to one thing. You mentioned possible decline of religion as one reason why giving changes. I'll just pick up on the faith element.
Yes, please.
One of the things we talk about in some of the training courses we run, which include storytelling, is the notion of going to church. There is one set of organizations, whatever your faith is, that the people do go back once a week with shared values and interests and so on and belief to tell and listen to stories. And that's church. And that's what, whether you mean it in a faith-based approach or just general collecting of people together. So that's one other thing that fundraising organizations can do. It's restore your need by listening to other people telling stories about the things that matter. So it's not uncommon. It's not an unusual thing. It's just maybe some of us have got out of the habit. And it's translating that to your sort of day-to-day work within the charity.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, actually, because you're right. Faith or church often centered around community. Even if people are recognizing now that even if they're not believers, if you like, that there's been a great, it's performed a valuable role in society, those institutions and that coming together. And as you say, whether it's shared purpose, understanding, trying to grow and be a better person, trying to make sense of, you know, human condition. So yeah, that's actually a really interesting point, how charities may be able to, probably today in a non sort of faith way, still bring people together around meaningful and purposeful things. I suppose that's a component of being involved with charities that might not be the first thing that comes to people's minds, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
But you do get value from contributing, giving back, helping others. It's a good part of mental well-being, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
And that's another challenge, as you know, particularly for fundraisers and chief execs of charities now. It's a huge,
burnout and stuff like that.
Absolutely, yes. Globally, certainly. Well, certainly in some of the areas that have been researched, USA, Canada, UK and Europe. It's a huge issue. And that's why some of these things do have a benefit.
Yeah.
Coming together, as you said.
Do you think that, because that is a known factor, that caregivers, a lot of people in the caregiving industries, you know, you take the weight of the world on your shoulders, maybe because the impetus to give more and do more is always there. It's hard to know where's the line where I put in a boundary and actually look after myself. You know, even in the church, going back, there's that sort of thing of potentially becoming like a martyr almost. What's your thoughts on that? Like, how is it changing, if it is changing in the sector?
It's changing because the recognition is there. Just the appalling mental health of many fundraisers is widely recognized. Some of the national bodies, so the Chartered Institute of Fundraising, of which I'm a member, have instituted training or coaching and other services to kind of address this and enable fundraisers to recover and manage their mental health better. I think, yes, it's far from dealt with. It's recognized, and that's a very important step, but so too are some of the services that are becoming available, and particularly for fundraisers, which is good.
Yeah.
It's one of the bigger challenges because it just compounds the turnover of fundraisers. Fundraisers have never stayed in jobs for very long. Usually, I think the average for a good chunk of my career was about 18 months.
In one organization or in fundraising at all?
In one organization. Sometimes in fundraising. I don't know about fundraising. But yeah, there's a definite leakage or hemorrhage of fundraisers leaving the profession. And there's research, I think, and I've read in the last week from the US of, I can't remember who was being researched, but it was fundraisers or a group of fundraisers. And something like, I think 30% were planning to leave their current job within the next six, 9 months. And something like a similar number were planning to leave the profession as well. Wow. So it wasn't they were just trying to find a better or different charity that managed them better or gave them more opportunities. It was the profession. So it's well known. It's not news at all in the profession, but it's addressing that is an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, we did a lot of work with the Chartered Institute for Fundraising as well. They do a valuable role, don't they, to kind of try and support fundraisers in all those various aspects.
Absolutely. I remember quite a few of the interviews you've done with the speakers and with some of their leadership as well.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you for that.
No, it was a pleasure. I remember many, many national conventions, you know, meeting so many great organizations. In terms of, without naming an organization, can you remember a campaign where you felt it really didn't work very well or it missed the mark on the point of view of learning what can sometimes go wrong or maybe where they didn't listen enough? You don't have to obviously give us the full context, but just something we might glean from that.
I go back to the idea of that things change and that fundraising can't stand still. I'll give you some examples. So years ago, a CEO sleep out was a successful event. You managed to get senior leaders at companies to actually experience homelessness for one night. That worked then. I think it still goes on, but generally that's not regarded as in any way appropriate. So that's not something that I think any charity would be undertaking now. We'll go back to the comic relief issue. For a while, celebs endorsing a charity and then actually going to meet some of the beneficiaries, the partner agencies that worked internationally, that worked. That was an appeal in the last few years. That has absolutely backfired, and comic relief have certainly changed their approach to who presents these stories. Life moves on. So I think there are lots of things that have failed like that. I think it's just any charity that speaks about itself is just not going to resonate with many people these days. It's the beneficiaries, it's the difference it makes, but told by someone else, someone who's... I'm coming around to the good examples when I should be trying.
No, absolutely. It's good to bring it back because they both sort of highlight each other, don't they? No, come back to the good examples, please. Yeah.
It's just stories that are absolutely powerful that for various reasons have not been shown the light of day. So one example that I'll give is the story of Jack, who was a boy at Clare House, a children's hospice in northwest of England. And his story was told by his mum. And Jack was given, had a limited lifespan. And there was this story that one of the nurses had not told because she didn't think the family would want to tell the story of what happened. But actually the story told by Jack's mum and why she chose Clare House, the benefits for her and the family after Jack's death were really, really strong and powerful. And it was only when the nurse realised that actually this was the kind of thing that would help Clare House, help other children, boys and girls like Jack, that she came forward and said, actually, I do have a story. And it was told with permission. And that became one of the main stories. This is about 10, 11 years ago. There was one absolutely key element that when the mum had told this story and said, I would love you to use that, she said, with one condition, do not change Jack's name.
Wow.
Which even as I say that now, just is very, very moving. She wanted Jack to live on in the memory and to have an impact. And anyone who got in the way of that was actually doing her a disservice and the charity. I can't prove that's directly related to that, to this. But 11 years on, the charity has achieved one of its big aims of reaching all the children it needs to in a certain area and is now ambitiously looking to what next? What more can we do?
Yes. And it's interesting because often I think what you're hinting at is a lot of times in charity stories, the names get changed. You know, the story almost becomes kind of sanitized. It becomes so produced or processed that it becomes sanitized. So the rawness of it, the unfiltered nature of it, the real name, the fact that he was a real person from that neighborhood are some of the things that are standing out for me. I always remember a very powerful phrase, what's most personal is most universal. Just to try and think about the ingredients of that story and why they're powerful, if you like.
Yeah, it's because there's no mention of money. That's not a fundraising ask at all. It's purely a story that shows the difference. The ability for the charity to carry on delivering its services, it makes that kind of difference every day. So yes, if you can tell that kind of story, then you are a long way forward to helping fundraise and generate income for a charity.
Yeah.
In the most profound way.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I've found as a film company coming in to help charities and other organizations tell their stories, sometimes, again, probably for budget reasons, there's a very task focus. So it's kind of like, we need to do this, and so we need to get straight into the production and the filming and stuff.
Yes.
And I think that one of the things that is often not as possible, often due to budget, but that starts much earlier in terms of at the board, in terms of seeing the value of investing the time, is the exploratory phase, the creative phase of trying to really find the good story or the powerful story. So if you go too quickly to the doing phase, then often it becomes very functional, process-driven, more the logical, like the comms messaging type stuff.
Yes, yes.
Rather than the heart. And that's frustrating. I think that's what's often sets apart those. And it doesn't have to be a complicated or big process, but just trying to find those, that gold before you rush to the next stage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you've been through that process, that challenging process quite a few times.
Yes.
You're right. That's how many charities approach fundraising and other activities. It's the kind of the tactics level. And maybe there'll be strategy involved. They're not daft. They're very skilled fundraisers around. But the one thing that separates charities that grow their income from those that just pretty much stay in the same line, even when they're the same size charity, same rough budget, same number of staff, it is this understanding of alignment. And that does mean stepping back. If you go straight into fundraising, and even if you have the best idea, even if it's a fabulous one-off viral campaign or something, the ice bucket challenge, great, use that, but that's only a one-year win. Important as that is, if you want to actually grow income sustainably, we know from the research by Professor Adrian Sargent that it's alignment within the organization. And that does mean stepping back. It means don't go straight into fundraising. Make sure the whole organization understands your purpose and understands how they can support fundraising. If you ignore the purpose, if you go for the sort of the practicalities first, you may do well, but it won't be ambitious and it won't be sustainable or unlikely to be sustainable.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm picking up for you on that point as well is unlocking all of that potential and all those potential stories across the organization from the most unlikely people sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, lovely. As we sort of finish up, you are once again at the cutting edge of things. I think it's GivingX, isn't it? You're looking at how to unlock fundraising at scale, but also looking at AI, which is, I guess, for some people, quite a controversial thing. It's also a huge opportunity. It's not going to go away. It's definitely here to stay, and it will become more and more part of the fabric of what we do. One of the things that I'm also navigating is, like, I can certainly see how, especially in terms of visuals and storytelling, it's at the hype stage right now. So there's a lot of like, wow, isn't that amazing? It can do this explosion and it can make this person, you know, disappear or whatever. But obviously in the impact space or the value space, there will be uses for it, but it'll be different than, say, in advertising, because we're more about real people, real stories. Yeah. So just curious to hear your thoughts on the space, the fact that we're talking about the fundraising charity space and how that, the use of AI may well be different from, say, the use of AI in just the pure entertainment space. So what are you learning? What are you coming across at the moment? What can you share?
Obviously, a huge amount of interest in it. Some of it from the early days. For most people, it was the arrival of ChatGPT in 2022. So we've had coming up for 3 years of that, and all the other competitors, most of them were around already for quite a while. It was just, it suddenly hit public consciousness. It's an essential tool. It doesn't make it easy, it's complicated, and it is moving faster than anything. And what I've, well, not enjoyed isn't quite the right word, but I've tried to note the what we learned from the early days of digital. So the arrival of the World Wide Web and email in many charity offices, that was not fast. The charity sector took a long time to embrace that, even though it was very clear from the early 90s, or 93, 94, this is going to change everything. So I think the sector has moved faster this time, maybe because we're just digital natives and most people expect
Yes.
You know, to be using digital and trying it out. I think there's multiple different levels. Yeah, you can't turn your back on it. That's obvious. It matters. You're already using it. You've been using it for a good number of years, whether it's machine learning or actual AI, when you've been choosing books or thinking about buying books online or whatever. I think the key thing is to be guided and to be provided with support, recognizing the challenges and threats to your reputation, to your data, to your professional respect. Work with people that have some track record in it. At the moment, it's not huge, so you are on the edge. Look at some of the work that's already been done. There's a great voluntary organization called fundraising.ai, and they, about 3 years ago, got together a whole bunch of people who had worked in digital and fundraising and comms and leadership around the world to come up with a policy document for safe and
almost
professional
like guidelines.
Guidelines, yes. Yeah. I mean, in a way, all of them made complete sense, but it was good to get that out very early doors after ChatGPT. And they run a free annual conference each year, all remotely, so anyone can log in. And they have some fabulous speakers. So again, we'll add that to the list
of resources.
Making
a note, yeah.
But yeah, they're voluntary. So I'm a part of their advisory board. And there are some really, really sharp people there. So look at whatever the guidance on that. Follow the guidance from the professional bodies. And I think absolutely come up with ideas, but test them within set boundaries that someone with probably more experience than you can guide you in. If you're a big charity, they may well have an expert. If they're not, then you're going to have to rely on either a third party, a commercial party, or professional body. So in our case, that's the Chartered Institute of Fundraising. But there are lots of other charities that are writing about this and sharing it online, how
real
they're
world.
Approaching AI. Yeah, exactly. Examples. So, yeah.
Which I think is very important, isn't it? Because it's good to have the theory and all of the policy and et cetera, but it's when it meets the real world that then you have to start to be making decisions about things and stuff. So people sharing their journey like that is great.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on, because obviously being a storytelling company ourselves, using film and animation and so on, we've started to use AI at many different stages of the process. However, just to optimize and to sort of facilitate certain parts of the process, but do you think we'll ever come to a future where the audience or the donors would accept, let's just say for argument's sake, to choose a sort of on-the-nose example, let's say a charity that's supporting people in part of the developing world that are really struggling with famine or something like that, that it would be okay or ethically okay to see AI generated images of that rather than real images of that?
That cuts right to the quick of AI, but also fundraising ethics and how to show respect for beneficiary service users. So I think, will it happen? It kind of already has. Various organizations have tried. AI generated imagery. Yeah. I mean, again, for a good reason. So I think Amnesty, I can't remember which country, but Amnesty used them with the argument that it protected the human rights activists that they were talking about, or people who'd taken part in street protests or something.
Okay.
So it was done with the best of intentions, but on that occasion fell foul, got picked up by the press and criticized. So it's not a case of saying never. The rules still apply of transparency, credit where it's due. I think it'll be a long time before actual human interaction and the ability to tell a story convincingly will be completely transplanted by AI. I'm not saying it won't happen and it won't happen faster than we expect, but I think the role for AI at the moment is at a different level. There's two levels. One, there's the kind of the efficiency processes that we all deal with every day. So the fact that you're using Microsoft or Google or something, you will be using AI and your organization needs to be aware of the implications of that and the importance of protecting data. The second one is the creative element. So AI is a creative tool, not just images, fine-tuning content, but also thinking differently. One of the great things I remember early on from ChatGPT was the ability to ask a question that was about, say, for example, charity or fundraising, but ask for it from a particular other sector or another time period or something. So really creative, trying to splice together something you would never think about, just to play with and see, are there insights that I've never thought of, or are there other ways of tackling a problem? So I think it's that bigger picture. We can't all spend our time doing that, but I think it's the ability to think differently or better in a way you've not been able to because you have access to such
huge data.
Data.
It's interesting, as you were talking there, like, I'm going to give you a big credit here. So it's almost like, you know, when you saw the advancement of digital, but not in the charity sector, and put the two together in the 90s. This is why I'm giving you a big credit here. And then Steve Jobs, he saw like art and technology and kind of put them together. So it's seeing these apparently, or seeing two things that are both great, but not necessarily connected, and bringing them together. So that you're right. That's something that not everybody in the past would necessarily have the capacity to see the pattern or the connection. But nowadays, we can just ask ChatGPT and it could probably give us five examples.
yeah, absolutely. You
know, it's incredible. So thanks so much for chatting to us today and sharing, you know, your many years of experience. In summary, anything you wanted to leave us with in terms of, for any of the storytellers out there or aspiring storytellers, fundraisers, what's one thing they could take away?
Practice storytelling. No one can do it perfectly the first time. Just practice it. Spread the message. Get everyone in your organization telling their stories. Your organization has a story. You have a story as a staff member or volunteer, and all your donors have stories. Listen out for those and tell your own.
Nice one. Thank you so much, Howard. Really great to see you after such a while.
Indeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully you got a lot from that conversation as I did when I was chatting with Howard. Please make sure to leave us a review, share some comments with us on social media. You can connect with Howard and a lot of the other great examples that we mentioned in there in the links in the show notes. Look forward to seeing you in a month's time, the first Sunday of next month, for our next episode. In the meantime, have a really fantastic month.